This is the Eugene Cernan interview for Tuesday, May 13th, 2003.
Cernan.
Yes, good morning. This is Anthony Young talking to Captain Cernan.
Yes, what is this about? I'm on the phone right now. Oh, okay.
I can call back in a few minutes.
Can you do that? Give me about 5 or 10 minutes.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
King Cernan's office.
Yes, sir. Good morning. This is
Anthony Young calling. Hi, Mr. Young.
Yes.
This is Claire. If you'll hold one moment, he'll be right with you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you. One moment, please.
Anthony, King Cernan.
Hi, Captain.
Sorry, I kept you so long.
That's not a problem, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to speak to you this morning.
Sorry it's been so difficult to get together, but life has been a little hectic over the last weeks.
Okay, great. Well, I have, of course, read your book and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great, thank you.
And I think I even worked up a sweat there when you were doing the EPA and the Navy mission.
Yeah, a couple people said they knew I was going to come out, but they weren't sure.
So it was very well written. And,
thank you.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.
And I think that was a real impetus for me to do some research on the LRB. Because Maggie and I were born in the past, worked with them quarterly, had never done an article on this amazing vehicle, so I started work on it. And I'm glad I have an opportunity to speak with you about it. Let me get right to the question.
Sure.
In your book, you mentioned the meeting with Von Braun, I think it was in 67, several years before.
Yeah, I was still a rookie before. Well, I flew in it was before. I think it was before I flew the first time. I got in the program in January 64. It was probably in 65. Because I flew Gemini in 66, and we were just a bunch of rookies that were just, I don't know how it happened to come about. He was in town, or maybe he wanted to meet with us, I'm not sure.
And it was at that meeting he actually brought the subject concept up to you. What exactly was it? Was he addressing you directly, or was it to
him? Well, there were probably six or eight of us at this table, and I'm not even sure who else was there, I think Roger was there, Chaffee was there, every week people were mesmerized. Here's Von Braun, he's talking to us, but the thing I remember specifically is, certain things you remember that someone says. What else went on that night, I'm not sure, but, you know, he said, don't you worry about getting to the moon. He says, I will get you there, and it is German, I will get you there, but it's what you do when you get there that's important. Don't worry about getting to the moon. I will get you there, you know, and I don't know, who knows what he had in mind. Of course, I guess they were working on concepts of the Saturn V at that point in time. And we'll get you there. In other words, don't worry about the rocket ride, kids. That's a piece of cake. It's my job. Worry about what you're going to do when you get there. And that's when he came up and he said, you'll be, he said, Gene, by the time, I don't know how he phrased it or whatever, but basically he implied, you know, we'll be driving cars when we get to the moon. And, you know, that was as far-fetched then as almost as far-fetched as going to the moon itself. And, he said, you'll probably be driving a car on the moon. You know, at that time, people were looking at flying shoes, you know, and all kinds of ways to propel yourself around in a 1/6 gravity. And people were talking about, I remember people talking about lunar rocket boots at that point in time. But he just said, you know, you'll probably be driving something. In fact, you'll probably be driving a car on the moon. Don't worry about how you get there. It's just what you do when you get there. You'll probably be driving a car. And you know, and that was just, sir, Dr. Von Braun, if that's what you say. You talk about a bunch of kids in a program at that point in time, having never even flown in between Mercury. And, you know, I guess Gemini had just about started about that time. Going to the moon was still a long way off, and he's talking about driving cars a quarter of a million miles away. they trained in the Midwest? I don't No, we trained all. We did a lot of training in some of the geology fields of Arizona. I remember up at Flagstaff. I know we used to rover up there quite a bit. We used to rover a lot at Kennedy, working and training on the 1G rover. That, well, I don't know whether was there one or two training vehicles. I'm not even sure. There had to be more than one. I'm sure.
Well, I think there was one used out in the Midwest area, like you say.
Well, the Midwest. I've never heard of anyone trained. There's no place to train in the Midwest, is there? Where did they train?
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding. You're right about the
Arizona. Midwest is Illinois and Indiana and those places. We trained out in Arizona in the deserts and lava fields and the cone crater area of northern Arizona. We did a lot of work out there with the rover.
Yeah. And there was a crater also in KMC.
Yep. Definitely used that one an awful lot. Well, the training at KSC was, we would set up mock stations there of what we might do when we got to some of the stations that we were limited where we could go with the rover. It was more, the training at KSC was more procedural in terms of how you get on a rover, how you load the rover, what you use when you take certain experiments off the rover, how you access them, it was, we were developing the procedure for the use of the rover and to make it as facilitating as possible, and because you know all we did, we just had a fairly, I don't know, probably half mile track at the rover where we could set up mock stations that we were going to stop at on the moon, and just how do you handle a rover, how do you get off, what problems you're going to have, does this fit, does that fit. It was out at Flagstaff that we actually used the rover as a geologic tool, if you will, for transportation to facilitate what we were doing geologically, because we could set stations, you know, quarter mile apart, half mile apart, and you know, how we navigate the terrain and how we get there from here, how we use the rover navigation system, how we, you know, that was more of the actual simulated training, where Kennedy was mostly working out procedures and how do you handle get on and off, and how do you handle your backpack requirements and those kind of things. Oh, we covered so much territory. I mean, time was the most critical thing on a lunar surface. We never had enough of it. And the rover, we could not only shorten the distance between places we needed or wanted to go or desired to go, but we could also do some geology on the way, as a matter of fact. Have both picture taking and rock sampling and a number of things while we're on the rover. Quite rugged, but you know, each slide built on the next, and where we went from Neil's slide in the middle of a vast mare or desert, we went to the highlands, you know, 15, 16, and 17 went to the highlands, and I would expect 17 may have been the most competitive for two reasons. Number one, it was in a northeast corner. We were off the equator. We were in the very eastern limb of the moon, so things changed quite drastically, and of course, that put the Earth over the mountains in the western sky. We landed in a valley that was surrounded by mountains on three sides, higher than the Grand Canyon is deep, to give you an idea of what the terrain looked like. And on the far end of the valley, there was, I guess you call it an escarpment, but it was almost like a big tiered dam, that if you could literally have filled this valley with water, the dam might have held it. And we couldn't go up the sides of the mountains with the rover, at least not very far, but we did cover almost to the top of that dam at the far end. We could, you know, zigzag hairpin turns to get up and down it. And the valley was about 20 miles long and about 5 miles wide. And, of course, within the valley were horrendous craters, large, small, large boulders, everything. So we landed, you know, when we pitched over at 7,000 feet, we were already below the mountaintops. Yeah, we were in it. We were down there. We were in it.
Yeah, I remember now reading your description of adventure, is not the word I think. But the landing itself.
Now, once we pitched over Weed Bed Valley, I almost felt like I'd been there before. I recognized a lot of craters. If you listen to our transcripts, we're just saying there's Pompey, there's BJ, there's this, there's, you know, Camelot. And so we was recognizable, and it was just a case of driving a vehicle down to where I wanted to land it. And then when we got closer, you know, committing yourself before you get down to about 200 feet, and then you get down through the dust, and you're committed to land, and the case then is making a safe landing. But no, it was a very recognizable place. As I say, we came in over the mountains behind us, with the mountains on both sides of Big Massif, north and south Massif on both sides. It just sort of funneled us into this valley. Massif, yeah, they call it M-A, yeah, I guess that's a geologic term of some kind, Massif.
I've been seeing massive bones.
Well, yeah, well, I guess Massif is...
Okay. Once you got the LRV deployed, of course, there's a very famous photograph of the
Yeah.
And that one, along with several, there'll be about 40 photographs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that picture you're talking about, first of all, that was when we unloaded a rover. That was a test run. That was a stripped-down rover. There was no equipment on it at all. If you look at it compared to everything else, it was just a test run to make sure everything worked. And in the first EVA, a lot of the effort and work was done. You know, it was not a short EVA. They were all close to 7-8 hours.
Okay, I meant
in terms of rover, because we spent at least, as best I recall, at least half of that EVA setting up the all-set package and lots of experiment package, you know, putting the flag up, doing all the deploying, what did we call the thing we deployed where all the equipment was? I forget what that big, it was like a big pallet that just we unfolded from the rover. That's where our equipment was. We had to get equipment out. We had to load the rover. We had to put all the electronic gear on the rover. All the, you know, we just had to, all that stuff took time. Deploying the all-set, a lot of, you know, here we are, let's get ready to stay kind of thing. And that took at least half the time, and we didn't have but probably a 2-3 hours at the most to do any true geologic work on that first EVA. So we didn't get very far away. Not at all. You adapt very, very quickly. 1/6 gravity is the greatest form of greatest environment you can live in. Far better than zero gravity, certainly. And far better than Earth gravity, because you can move so much more easily and quickly. You just got to be able to plan ahead, and you know, you still got the same amount of momentum and inertia, and know when you're going to turn and stop. But as far as getting around, you know, you pick the rover up and turn it around. It's just 1/6 gravity is absolutely phenomenal environment to live in and work in. Well, the one she had rubber tires, and we had those piano wire tires, if you want to call it. But it responded as you might expect in 1/6 gravity. I mean, you were bouncing up and down. You hit a bump, you hit a crater. You're going to go up on three wheels half the time. And you know, we had I think a limited horizontal velocity of about 12, 14 kilometers per hour. I think I hold a speed record. I came down off of that escarpment I talked to you at the end of the valley at about 17 kilometers per hour. So it handled very well. I didn't have any problems with it. The thing that Jack didn't like is when I'd be on the side of a hill, and he was on a downhill side. It always felt like you're going to fall over, like you're going to roll over. Can you hold on 1 second? Let me get this. Go ahead, Anthony. Yeah, when you're on a side hill, being a commander and being a driver, I kept Jack on the side, downhill side most of the time. It was pretty uncomfortable for him because 1/6 gravity, you didn't feel like you had the rover being held down to the surface very, very strongly. Well, we were both, you know, you both tend to lean up the hill.
Yes.
But for him, it's just a little bit less comfortable than it was for me. We laugh about it. I did it on purpose.
Okay. Because there's one photograph, one of the last ones that appeared in the article, of Judge Schmidt. And he is, the big bowl with Grover Park here, and he is really leaning into that hill.
Where that boulder was, I took the pans of pictures of the boulder and the Panhandle Valley. That hill, that was on the south, on the north. North Massif, and that doesn't look very steep, but let me tell you, that was a very steep hill. I had to climb up there and left the rover down by the rock, and you can see, you sort of see how the rover is leaning. But let me tell you, that was a steep hill.
Yes.
Very steep hill. Oh, well, when you say what it allowed us to do was that it allowed us to explore the entirety of this this valley of which I spoke, from literally from one end to the other, north to south, to climb up hills. We never would have been able to climb up on foot. It was just too tiring and too difficult. It's one thing that's very, very tough on a surface. You can't really judge inclines and distances and sizes very well. And rover allowed us to cover this entire valley from both a scientific and a geologic point of view, and bring back samples and get pictures from places we never would have been able to get them from had we not. We never would have been able to get to these places. I think that's the most significant thing about the rover. It just was so versatile and gave us so much additional advantage while within the time frame that we had on the moon, that without it, you could have probably cut down our science and our geologic exploration by about 70%. I mean, I don't think we could have got 30% done of what we eventually did get done without the rover. It's just a phenomenal asset.
Well, one last question here. You were obviously well aware of this last mission, and we've not known how long it might be to return. I guess that weighed pretty heavy on your heart.
A little disappointing. When I left, I remember climbing up that ladder, looking down at those footprints, and since the Earth was, in our case, low on the horizon, and all the other flights, it was overhead. I mean, it was just in our view all the time, particularly when I looked over my shoulder climbing up the ladder. There was the Earth, and there was my footprints, and I knew very well that that I personally would not be back this way again, and that it might be some time before someone else was, but never in my entire life did I think it would be a generation. I thought we'd be on our way, not only back to the moon, but on our way to Mars by the turn of the century. So it's a dubious honor to still be the last man to have left his footprints on the moon at this point in time. But my glass does not have empty and half full. Because I think there's some young kids out there, young boy or girl, as I said in my book, with the endowment of global courage, that are going to take us back out there where we belong. And it's this increment of time will probably be a hiccup in history, because we are going back and we are going to Mars. There's a couple other things about the lunar rover. One, of course, you realize I knocked a fender off.
Yes, that's true, and I've got a really good photograph of your excellent
repair
job.
Yeah, and that was a very an engineering feat. And you know, the thing that made it possible was the fact that we took duct tape to the moon.
Yes, that's true, and it's a very good photograph.
Yeah, but we had to use the tape inside the spacecraft because it won't stick with all the lunar dust down there. And then once we got it down there, we couldn't tape it to the existing fender. We had to use clamps because, again, the lunar dust would just make the tape useless. But we did have duct tape to the moon, and obviously we needed a fender because the lunar soil was so, the lunar dust was just terrible.
And you see the photographs, and it's just such a right to begin with, an hour or two difference.
Well, look at photographs of me and my suit sometimes, and there's one of me in the cockpit, and it looks like I'm a coal miner. There's one other thing, you know, there have been some lunar rover mock-ups built that are in different places. There's a great one up at Kansas Cosmosphere, because they built a couple of them. And you probably don't know this, but the Omega Watch Company, the people who built the watch, made the watch we walked on the moon with, I've been doing some things with them for about 10 years. They have a full-scale, drivable lunar rover. It's almost an exact replica of a mock-up of what we drove on the moon. And just for your information, they use it to help support and, if you will, market the space program around the world. I mean, I've driven that lunar rover on the streets of London. I've driven it at St. Moritz. I've driven it in China, on the Great Wall of China. I've driven that rover. I've driven that, that rover's been driven in New York City. That rover is becoming perhaps more famous than the ones we moon. It's all, it's a drivable, workable hand controller. Everything works the same way. Articulated steering, everything. Of course, the tires are different. Well, two people. They Omega did much of the work, but the Kansas Cosmosphere also did part of it.
And
so between,
Kansas
Cosmosphere, which is probably one of the best museums in the world.
I will have to go.
You have to. It's phenomenal. You need to go up to Hutchinson, Kansas.
Yes.
Before you write this book, you need to go there.
But
anyway, between the two of them, they've made this rover, and it's been all over the world.
That's great. I've got to make mention of that because of course Omega's on
all the main. Well, yeah, we flew all of every watcher was worn on the moon was worn with an Omega.
That's great.
And,
okay.
Okay. If you got any other questions, just call.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
I'll be sending you a rough draft here.
Great. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, sir.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.